Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.
Here is the thing about wearing Quince. Because I adore my Mongolian cashmere tees, I told my mother-in-law and her sister, and now everybody is buying them for themselves and for gifts this holiday season. I don't just love them as a sponsor, I love them as a gift that I know is going to hit the right note. Quince pretty much has your whole list covered. The Mongolian cashmere sweater tees for $50 when you would normally pay $200 or more. The kind you'll wear on repeat. Then there's denim that goes with everything, tops and skirts for when you need to look put together, cashmere hats and scarves and down jackets that will actually keep you warm. By working directly with trusted factories that maintain high standards for both craftsmanship and ethical practices, and by cutting out the middlemen and markups, Quince is able to pass those savings straight to you. I have the sleeveless cashmere tee in oatmeal, true to size, and the t-shirt cashmere sweaters in gray and oatmeal. I could wear them every day. I rotated them through my meetings when I was in LA and then back to my work from home setup. They're so versatile, classy, and I don't have to think twice about whether it is the right moment. They are always right for the moment. Quince also has home, bath, and kids products. I adore the shark print swim trunks for my sons. Find gifts so good you will want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/TSNOTYAW for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/TSNOTYAW to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/TSNOTYAW.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary.
Welcome everyone to a very special episode of our podcast. Listen, we've had some really fun original episodes on the show, but I feel like today's episode will become a fan favorite. This is my prediction. Let's see if I'm right or not. So we have, if you're on Zoom, you already know, we have all four of my fantastic colleagues at Wendy Sherman Associates. So we have, of course, Wendy Sherman, our veteran, our eponymous founder, the veteran publishing professional that everyone wants to be. We have Cherise Fisher, who recently got a new title at the agency. She is now the vice president, although I heard that a few people call her the queen. So we'll have to ask her about that. Laura Mazur. Laura Mazur's our superstar on the West Coast with a heart of gold and a genius editorial eye. And we have Callie Dietrich, who, until I joined the agency, would call herself the resident millennial. And so now we also have me. We have me because I, in addition to being here as your co-host today, I am here as a literary agent with my colleagues. And the goal is to give you guys kind of like a fly on the wall experience. So I want all our listeners and our viewers on YouTube to be able to say that you got to listen in on a meeting, a literary agency's meeting. And of course, we're going to be super mindful of confidentiality. We're not going to say names that we're not supposed to say or figures that we're not supposed to say. It will be a little different from actually being a fly on the wall. But hey, it's close enough and I'm super excited. So welcome everyone. I'm super excited to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Everyone's smiling and nobody knows when to say. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go in the following order saying hi. Wendy, Cherise, Laura, Callie. Okay, go.
Hello. Hello, and so thrilled to be here.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cherise. It is amazing to be here. Cece and I are old hats because she did my first Instagram Live with me. So it's great to be back on the screen with her.
So happy to be here too. This is very fun. Cece, thanks for inviting us to do this with you. And I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Hi, it's Callie. This is actually my first podcast ever. So I'm so honored and I feel really safe to be surrounded by my team at WSA. So let's get this going.
I love that. I love that. Your first podcast ever. Okay. I feel like we should just begin by having like our usual meeting again, being mindful that this will be on the internet.
Forever.
Yeah, forever. Exactly.
Forever.
So how's everyone's week going so far? Callie, how's your week?
My week's been pretty good. I've been reading this romanticy that I can't put down, but I've been wondering if we think that like the bubble has popped yet. Do you think there's still room for more romanticy, or is it so saturated that, like, you know, I haven't represented romanticy yet, but I do enjoy reading it for fun. So I was kind of curious what your all's thoughts are.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because today was the last day of a class that I teach at City College, Introduction to Publishing. And I had about 16 or 17 students this year, and they're all rabid fantasy readers. In fact, on the last class, they present their book ideas. And so half of them picked these fantasy books. And we had actually a very lively conversation about where this trend came from. I did tell them that it seemed often as though editors and agents were kind of tired of the trend, and they were like, oh my gosh, no. If this trend ever stops, I don't know what I would do. I think that these ideas that fantasy or romanticy is over, I think they're overblown, because the actual people who read it are very attached to the genre and to the whole idea of world building.
That's a relief.
Yeah, that's a great point. Such a great point. But I'm going to add that people who are public and fans and reading are loving it. And then publishing professionals need to be thinking about the fact that it's as much as 2 years from when we might read a novel and decide if we want to represent it until it's actually on the bookshelves.
Very true.
So it's hard to calculate exactly what any trend is going to go for and how it's going to last. But we do our best. And again, I think it's always good to just go with your gut, with what you love, because then you can sort of be a trend buster and not a trend follower.
Very helpful.
I feel like it says so much, Callie, that you're like loving it, because like to your point, it's not a genre you've ever repped, right? And like, I know you're like me in this respect, which is if you fall in love with a story, it's so rare that you're like, you have to try it. You can't not try it.
Yes, but there's always in the back of your head questions about how will this fit in the marketplace, all that kind of stuff that you have to weigh as well. I just wanted to hear all your thoughts about it, so thank you.
That's totally fair. Laura, how's your week?
Wait, I love this question about when we dive into other topics and different categories. It's so true. If you fall in love with something, you want to champion it. That's why we do this job, for the people and the stories and the ideas that we put into the world. But each category, each topic, each angle has its own rubric, and they're very nuanced rubrics that editors have in mind. And if we don't know what they are and we go out to editors and say, look, we're so excited about this, we want to know that they're going to be excited too. We don't always have those crystal balls to tell us what on that particular day is the nuance they're having in mind. Is romanticy over? I don't think it is. I think it's here to stay, actually. We'll see what happens. But I'm always so eager to try something new and branch out. My own rule for myself is only one new category at a time. So I'm all over the place when I'm discovering. But if I can choose one new category at a time, immerse myself, learn the best practices for that particular category, then typically it works out a whole lot better.
It's a smart rule. I like that rule. Yeah.
It's a lot of self-control, though, right? It's a lot of self-control. Because if you fall in love with something, it's hard to say no to it.
I mean, for me, it's impossible. It's not hard. I can't do it. To me, it's like resisting a chocolate chip cookie. Like, I can't. I will not resist.
I like too many things. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You have to know the people. You have to know the trends. You have to know the nuances. You have to know what's working, what isn't working on a very micro level. And if I don't feel confident, then I don't want to only stick to my own categories forever and forevermore. I want to branch out. We all do. We want to do more and get greater, bigger, more exciting stories out into the world. But I have to set a limit, or else I'm scrambling in too many different directions at once. So I have my core categories that I know I love. I feel right at home in them. And then here and there, I'll bring in something new or different and see how that goes.
One day, this reminds me of your really good perspective on aging thing, which is like, we're like, We're like managing a hedge fund. So we need to diversify. You know, we need to make sure that we have like a diverse portfolio because trends come and go. And so, yeah, I think that's really interesting.
You do, and you can't put all your stock in one thing, because then if that thing is over, you're stuck with the wrong basket, right? So I love the idea of trying different things and opening yourself up. I think as an agent, it's easy to feel like you're in a rut, but it's fun to just challenge yourself. And fortunately, we have access to information where if we need to figure out like what editor might be perfect for a particular book, we can do the research on Publishers Marketplace by, you know, seeing who's acquiring what. We're not always right, but I think we have access to that information, and it's fun to kind of stretch your muscles.
And yeah. The Publishing Whisper Network.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And like, I'm sure we all have that one editor per imprint that we can call because we're friendly. Yeah. And you can be like, who at yours would be perfect for XYZ? That's so valuable.
I love that we're talking about this because I feel like one of the things we do here that I love is that we brainstorm with each other about who the right editor might be for a project. Because we all have different relationships, right? We all have different friendships over the years. We kind of get the brain trust of the five of us every time we're going with a project.
Oh, yeah.
That to me is gold. That.
Yeah, it's definitely... Like, I feel so safe when I go out with a project, being at Wendy Sherman Associates, because I know, like, it's not just my brain that my client's getting. It's everyone's brain.
Mm-hmm. Cece, you've already taught me things as well. Like, I love your idea. Since you've joined the agency, too. Yeah. You've taught me things.
Was it about chocolate chip cookies?
Definitely. Or now I know what a Brigadeiro is. Yeah. On a real note, Cece, I loved your idea of including the pitch letter in the manuscript so that it's always like easy access for an editor. I'm like, that's just brilliant. So that's why like it's so great to hear other point of views when we're working this business.
Oh, thank you.
Publishing is not a zero-sum game. We're all in it together. There's always room for more good books. And what I love about our industry is we can ask each other, and not just in this group, we can ask each other, thank goodness, I don't know what I would do without all of you. But I also, speaking to the Whisper Network, I have other agent friends and people who do maybe overlapping categories, and I can shoot them a little WhatsApp or Slack or email or text and say, hey, I'm going out with this. Who do you think would be a great editor for it? And everyone is always so lovely about answering. It's nice to have friends who are agents at other agencies, fresh perspectives, different intel. Obviously, there are certain things we have to keep to ourselves, and we do, but there's just no reason why we can't all support each other and champion each other. And I love that about our industry. And when people, on the rare occasion, I meet an agent who's more buttoned up and not so interested in collaborating, I think, well, this is an outlier. The rest of us, I think, are very share and share alike with information.
Definitely true.
I love that. Okay, Charisse, how's your week going?
It's going pretty well. I have an author coming out with a book in February, Sadiqua Johnson, Keeper of Lost Children. And I have an author who's coming out with a book in June, The Misconnection. And for both of them, so early on, we're in the process of doing the behind the scenes pre-order marketing stuff. I mean, it seems kind of crazy to be thinking about pre-ordering for a book that is in June. And it's not that we expect someone to pre-order the book today, although some people did. We did the cover reveal this week. It was a cover that was entirely different from the direction that we were going in originally. And we had to make a very quick decision about what the new cover would be, because we announced the cover reveal with Goodreads, big supporter of her books and a huge reading community. So we were very excited that they wanted to do the cover reveal for us anyway. So we did the cover reveal, and just the reception for this cover that we've made a decision about in like 3 days was very exciting. It's like, oh, wow, I guess we did the right thing because everybody's loving it. You know, it's really spreading far and wide. So that happened this week, which was always nice to see. People now calling us for copies. When is it going to be ready? The movie people want to know when it's going to be ready. Our sub writes the person, all those people. There's all this like buzz happening for it, which is exciting. Even though it seems like a far away, it's not really far away. And then Sadiqa's book, Keeper of Lost Children, is not far away at all. Like, I feel like that book's coming out tomorrow. And in her case, we're kind of finalizing the pre-order. Although the pre-order can't really happen in December because people are focused on spending their holiday money. So we have to have everything ready to go in January. It's just an exciting time, but it just reminds me that there's so many more expectations on our authors in terms of marketing than there ever has been before. It feels like that to me. I've been in the industry for quite some years, and the responsibility, what falls on the author nowadays, seems like so much more than 10 years ago. Would you agree with that, you guys? Like, I just feel like there's so much more that they're expected to do. And consequently, there's so much more that we as agents are expected to do as a result of the fact that there's so much more. Our authors come to us, they don't necessarily know how to do a pre-order campaign. They don't necessarily know how important it is to get a ring light. I remember during 2020, that was like the ring light season. I was like, you had to get a ring light, you know? And all of a sudden, we're agents. I'm an agent by day, but I'm also a set designer. Like, what's behind you? Let's curate the background, you know, all of those ways in which our industry is changing, how our jobs are evolving. And I actually kind of love it. But this week, because of the cover reveal, because of this pre-order campaign that we're launching, it made me realize that as an agent, we're ever expanding what our responsibilities are. It's a good thing.
Couldn't agree more, Therese. It is just, it's where we get to be all things to all people. The authors have to do the same. And I think frankly, the editors have to do the same thing. You know, I think editors need to be in so many different departments. They have to be knowledgeable about every step of the way. Totally. And hands-on. And that, I don't think that was necessarily true 10 years ago even, because there were people in departments that did things, and they're still there. Yeah. But the editor needs to sort of project manage every step of the process with us as partners.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
10 years ago, we were pretty close to where we are now. Obviously, the pandemic changed a lot of it and kicked it into high gear. Mm-hmm. Maybe 20 years ago was different, but I think 10 years ago, we were still seeing the same pressure on editors to do everything, be that point person for all departments, both in-house and for the author. Now agents have more to participate in, though, because mm-hmm. as the publishers are ramping up their reliance on the author to provide visibility for their books. Without visibility, no one can buy it. That authors somehow feel everyone's looking at me to spread the word that this exists. And if they're not sure how to go about doing that, the publisher can help, absolutely, but it's really the agent who's in the corner all the way and can sit down with them slowly, think through what do you have to work with? Who are your people? Where can we find them? Let's go find them and speak to them and meet them where they are and tell them about your book. If we don't have visibility for the book, people can't buy it. And it used to be that publishers were fairly confident that if they selected a book and they felt that they loved this book and were investing in it, they could get visibility for it. They could get publicity. They could have a really successful marketing campaign. Today, with this crazy, noisy world we have, there's no guarantee, especially when we're planning anywhere from 6 months to 2 years ahead of time. Mm. There's no guarantee that any book is going to get the attention you want it to from external media, from other people who are uninvested, like newspapers, magazines, podcasts. So the only thing we know absolutely for sure is that the author is going to be motivated to have people see their book. So agents and editors agents and authors are getting together and strategizing, and editors and authors are getting together. Everyone's strategizing. How do we get eyes on this?
Yeah. I feel like this reminds me of when an editor once told me, she got asked a question at this roundtable. which was, what's something agents do that you don't like and that you wish they didn't do? And she said, well, some agents, not most of them, but some, they disappear after a project sells. And I can only imagine like how difficult that must be, right? If an agent does disappear, like all of a sudden you don't have that contact person. And that's really important. And I mean, I'm pretty sure it's not very common because you know, that's not good agenting behavior, but you just need the agent there to really give the author support, but also be able to like talk to the editor and just be that bridge, the person who can calm them down and kind of like give perspective too, which is so important.
That happens all the time. The agents sell the book and then they come back when the book is ready to pub and say, all the time. So I don't know if of course my team knows, but for anyone watching, 5 years ago, I made the switch from being in-house as an acquisitions editor to being an agent. I switched from buying to selling. And so for most of my years working in publishing, I was on the acquisition side. Agents would come to me bringing their projects, and it was my job to help assess which were the right projects for my team, whatever team I was in at that particular moment. And so I saw all the agenting ways that all the ways that agents can do what they do. And it was very common, I'm sorry to say, very common that agents would sell the book and then disappear. They'd put us in touch and then they'd be gone. And they might show up for contract things. They might show up for something critical. Other than that, we really didn't hear from them again until the book came out. I think this is very sad. I also, however, saw all the wonderful agents. I saw Wendy. Wendy and I did a number of books together. And every time we did a book together, that's how you do it. You show up for the important decisions. You're collaborative. You join the team of author, agent, publisher to help make everything the book can be and not see it as you against us, them against him. The plan is for us all to participate in the creation of a very successful book. And agents have a lot that they can do in that space if they step up and do it. We do it. That's how we run our agency. That's how we do things. I love that. I would be very sad for an author who had the kind of agent who sells their book and then goes away.
I mean, it sounds terrible. I just want to say that different agents are good at different things. When people ask me advice about how do I know what agent should I pick? I'm like, well, it depends on what you want. Those agents who come in, do the hard sale and come out, they're on to the next sale. And if you as a writer wanted more than anything, someone to get you a really big, fat, juicy number, that might be a good fit for you. If you are someone who, let's say you have a particular business about, you know, selling eyeglasses. And this, you're not a career author. You're somebody who sees the opportunity to get a bit of extra cash into your business by doing this book. And you're not into the handholding, and you've hired a writer to actually write it. And you don't have the kind of creative investment that we're talking about. The person that comes in and gets you the biggest sum of money, it might be right for you. I just think on the other side, there are some editors who are so precious editorially that they might sit there and work on your manuscript for 4 years because they don't think it's perfect yet. So they might not have any sense of urgency, right? That might not be the right fit to you. Maybe they want to be there to hold your hand through everything, and maybe you don't need that. I don't know. I mean, I think that different people want and need different things. It's certainly not the way we do things, but I do think that there are people out there who want that kind of agent.
I hear what you're saying, Charisse, but I'm going to disagree a little bit and say I don't know anybody who would benefit from having someone just come in, make the sale, and disappear. Because what agents have to offer and the role that we play in today's publishing environment is so much more than that. And I do think you can get someone who does all of that. Mm-hmm. And if you're only getting someone to make the deal, maybe you just need a lawyer. I don't know. To me, I wouldn't suggest that to anyone, but I feel as though you can have, I think most agents I know are really hands-on every step of the process. They come in, they're very particular about who they submit the project to. They are very clear and mindful about not just finding the right editor, because that's the imprint the editor works with, but that they feel like there's like an alignment. You know, I love that word, alignment. There's an alignment in terms of how those two people are going to work together, because once you're in the trenches, we all know there's going to be bumps in the road. You want to have that person who's sitting by your side and standing up for you. We've all been there as agents, every one of the five of us, where you need to get involved and push back on something and stand up and really make a fuss, if you will, to make sure that the client gets what they're looking for and what their book deserves. So I do think, yes, there are bad agents. Let's be honest. There are people who I wouldn't recommend. I'm not going to name that. It doesn't matter. But you can have someone who ticks all the boxes.
You could definitely have someone ticks all the boxes. There's five of them right here. You know, there's five of them right here. But my point is that it doesn't necessarily make them a bad agent. It makes them a bad fit for you, I think. And a bad fit for the typical author, maybe.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But.
It's a luck thing. If you have one of those agents who, I'm going to sell your book and then I got to move on. I got other stuff to do. So hope it goes well. That can work, but there's a little bit of luck involved because you have to be lucky that you like the cover they give you, that they don't change the title and subtitle without consulting you appropriately, that they set a pub date that works for you, that all of the decisions your publisher is making along the way, and there are many, many, many of them, are going to work for you. Because at the time that something happens, if your publisher makes a decision you don't like, cover, title, subtitle, timing, campaign, or they skip a step in the process of making a good, successful book, it's unlikely the author will catch it on their own. This is why I'm always telling my clients, you see me on everything. I don't care. Fill up my inbox. It's really, really fine. It's much easier for me to catch when something is about to go a tiny bit awry on the front end than for me to find out later something went awry and now I have to go back and try to untangle something and fix it when the deadline might have already passed, right? Like, so the day before a book goes to the printer, probably not the time to alert me that you hate your cover. But if I'm there the moment that those covers show up in your inbox and you're saying, I don't really love this, then I can do something about it. I can advocate, I can get in there and have a good conversation. If you leave the agent out of it, there are steps that can be missed or choices that can be made that are not advantageous.
Totally true.
I 1,000% agree with that. And I always tell my clients, CCing me is my love language. Like, you want to make
it's
me
in
feel
your name.
Happy? CC.
It's your first name.
Yes.
It's in your name.
CC, CC. Like, please. Yeah. And it's just important because a good agent will do everything you described, Laura. And then sometimes they're also able to, in addition to all that, spot things before they even happen. Like, the cover should be here by now. Hold on. Or I haven't heard anything about format yet or print run or whatever it is. Like, we can sometimes anticipate issues. Like,
because we know what's happening. Yeah.
Exactly. And so much of what we do for our clients is like not letting the bad stuff even happen in the first place.
Yeah. And I feel like we're working behind the scenes. So we're not always CCing our author. So like sometimes you got to have an aside with the editor, be like, are we sure about that pub date? Like things where you don't want to alarm the author, but you have your concerns that you wouldn't know about if you weren't in the loop.
True. So.
And let's add to this controversy that there is a chance, a reasonable chance, that by the time, from the time you sell your book until the time that you hand in your manuscript and when it's published, your editor might not be there anymore.
Yeah, I was just about
to say. The editor you sold the book to. And then who is your anchor inside the publishing house? Now, I've seen it happen where the editor that comes in as, you know, we call it being orphaned when an editor leaves, and then the author is given to another editor. It doesn't always turn out badly at all. I mean, I've seen it happen in a great way, but it is like a major bump in the road that needs to be you have to oversee it to ensure that the author still feels cared for and loved and make sure that the project is getting the attention it deserves and would have had if that original editor who went out of their way and fought to buy the book, now they're gone. Now you've got to go in there and really push for it.
Absolutely.
Another 100%. Factor in this is that even if you do have the same editor, if the editor's team is telling the editor, don't change the cover, don't change the title, don't change the pub date, the editor works for the boss and the team in house, but we get to work for the author. And obviously, we're not going to advocate, champion a wish of our authors that is irrational. But if it's a rational wish, we can champion them 100%. It feels so good to say there's something went awry here. It needs to be fixed. Whereas an editor can't always do that. I think they always want to. I think editors really want to make their authors happy. But if they go back to their team and say, my author's not happy, they don't like this cover, they don't like this, whatever it is that's problematic, and the boss says, well, change their minds, that's the editor's job, go change their minds. That's a hard thing to grapple with all by yourself. That's when you need your agent in there who can do a better job of it for you.
That also reminds me of when I sell a book to an editor, I really try to make sure I'm selling it to an imprint. So I really want to make sure that there is an editor in chief or an editorial director that's enthusiastic about it. I'd love to be able to know that the publisher is enthusiastic about it. I love having those meetings, right? Before we sell a book, I love having a meeting with the publishing company where there's a publicist that shows up, where there is an editor in chief that shows up. Because if you have the support of the entire imprint, should one person out of that team be somewhere else, there's still a foundation and there's still relationships that I have with other people at the imprint that can help keep the enthusiasm going over the book.
I love that insight. Okay, now, Wendy, how's your week going so far?
Yes, how's your week, Wendy?
Oh boy. That's
our fearless leader. How's your week?
I'm going to preface this by saying we're coming up to the end of the year, so there's like a lot of stuff happening that happens as the year comes to a close. So we're closing a few deals still, which is exciting, and we're putting out a few fires, which is not so exciting, but it has to be done. And I would say like things are kind of intense right now. I think that there's like a pressure that comes at certain periods of time in publishing, because publishing closes for the holidays, and because like at the end of the summer, people feel like pressure that they want to get things done. That's just to say that I think things are pretty intense right now. And I have talked to editors this week who are like, wow, it is just wild right now. And I just think we're all trying to finish up business. And that just, it makes it fun and exciting and challenging all at the same time. And I mean, we know that people in publishing never really take a break, right? I mean, I don't think they do. I know I don't. I don't know if all
of you. It's a myth. Like, oh, publishing slows down in December. Like, look at all of us. Okay, so for our listeners, today is December 9th. I know that this will only air in 20 days, but it's December 9th. We are supposed to be slowing down, okay? Meanwhile, we're each super busy with everything from like new clients that we're speaking to, potential new clients, buyers we're putting out, deals we're closing, editorial calls that we're having. Charisse has all the publicity things that you mentioned. Like, it's a lot. Kelly, you had lunch with someone, didn't you? About a book?
Yes, I did. I had lunch recently with Lori at Crown. Maybe I'm not supposed to name names, but we're working together
It's public information. Yeah.
We're working together on a speculative debut that I sold her this summer. So we had lunch recently, and she gave me an advanced copy of this book that's coming out in May and going to be huge. So I'm like, that's the fun part of publishing when you get these books ahead of the public. And I'm like, this.
Wait, she gave you an ARC for a May book?
Yeah. And it's going to be really big. This author, she's like a huge podcaster. And I think there was already like massive pre-orders, and I'm loving it. I'm really enjoying it. I'm like, should I plug a different agency's book? I don't know. But that's like, it's really fun to get those insights and kind of see into the future a little bit.
You can plug anything. We're generous. We're generous, loving people who want authors to succeed. Like I feel very strongly that, like, I'm going to borrow Laura's words. This is not a zero-sum game.
No, definitely not. Yeah. So it's really great to have those one-on-ones with editors and get that face time, and you learn things that you never would have known about them otherwise. So it's really valuable.
What I think is, I mean, for my week, like, I am so excited about certain things that are happening that I'm not allowed to talk about, but having some really great conversations about a project. At the same time, it's December. So it's one of those situations where contacting people and getting everyone to be like on the same page is such a challenge. And I'm also like kind of celebrating you guys because I signed a new client.
Yay! Yeah.
She signed the contract today. So it was a referral by my client, Laura Loeffler. It's for a fantastic novel. She's written a really terrific thriller, like a psychological thriller, upmarket. Nice. So fun. So like really excited about that. So it's a celebratory
Congrats.
Week.
So I'm going to share like one of the fun things for me right now is I'm actually going to a luncheon tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I think a luncheon means like there's more than two people. But I'm going to a publishing luncheon tomorrow. I think there are going to be eight people there, women. And we're all in, you know, really interesting different positions in publishing, marketing, editorial. Obviously, I'm an agent. All these different things. And I think it's going to be fun to really dish and share Ooh. Insights on how our companies are doing and what's happening behind the scenes in each person's area of work. And so that's just something I'm looking forward to. You didn't ask the question, but I'm just throwing it out there that one of the things we don't get to do quite as much as we used to, which is to really have sit down face to face, talk to people, share ideas, see who's excited about what, and get each other excited about the books that we're excited about. So I'm really looking forward to that tomorrow.
Where's the luncheon? Where that. Is it? Not that, I mean, it's going to be 29.
It's at a very bougie restaurant in Manhattan called Robert.
Oh.
And it's gorgeous. And anyway, it's going to be fun. You won't find me around tomorrow at lunchtime. So I'll be.
Put a little recording device under the table so we can all hear it.
We might all have to sign an NDA.
An NDA.
I feel like that's just understood. It's us. Like it's the paternal WSA NDA. It actually rhymes, so it's cute. Okay, so actually, Wendy, your comment is great because it's a perfect seg into some of the audience questions that we're going to take. So some of our listeners sent in questions. There was a very select group of listeners that I reached out to. I do not want a mutiny in my hands. So we did get way more than I will be asking. I'm going to choose a few. Please, if your question is not answered, don't get mad at me. There's limited time because we all have to go sell books. You know, we wish we could be here all day, but we have to go sell books. So, okay, everyone's going to say one thing, like one-liner answers, okay? What's something about the old days of publishing, think martini lunches and self-addressed stamped envelopes, that you would bring back if you could? Wendy, you go first.
I'm going to say time. I think there was a pace that was a little more luxurious and, you know, the work got done, but it wasn't quite as intense every single hour of every day.
Wendy would bring back luxurious pace. I love that. Charisse, what would you bring back if you could?
Why did I know that you were going to go to me next? What would I bring back?
I'm going to go to you last. I can do that.
No. I mean, I'm going to deal with it head on. What would I bring back? I mean, it's interesting. Back in the old days, I was on the other side of the desk. I guess one of the things that I miss is being able to pick up the phone and talk to people very easily. Nowadays, you have to schedule a phone call with someone. Mm-hmm. Remember those days when it was just like you knew you called this number, it was a landline, and they picked up, or they put you on hold, or they called you right back. Like it was just a lot easier to talk to people. I actually started when I started in publishing in the summer of 1994, I did not even have an email address. Neither did my boss, right? Like, so we talked to each other a lot more, you know, and I miss those days of being able to call someone immediately and get them within a day. Now it's a little bit more complicated.
That's a great one. Being able to pick up the phone and call someone. Okay.
Spontaneously.
Yeah. Laura, you go.
I am going to be controversial here and say I miss BEA. Book Expo, the big conference at Javits Center, all
you
the
stole
editors.
Callie's answer.
I love BEA.
Well,
you stole mine because mine is also, I really would like to slow the pace down, have a little more time to focus on each individual project. But I had to pivot, Callie, so start thinking. It's a pivot. Because BEA, I know not everybody loves it, but what an exciting thing to walk up and down the halls, see what everyone's doing all at once. It was a little bit of like a high school reunion vibe sometimes because you'd bump into people you worked with 3 imprints
That's
ago.
True.
Right. That was so fun. And it gives you an opportunity to catch up that wouldn't find its way to you in another manner. It's just like this organic, beautiful way to all come together and have a chit chat in the lane and bring some fun books home and maybe a tote bag or two and a pen and all that swaggy stuff. I loved it. I miss it. I'm holding by that.
Callie, you don't have to think of a new one. You can just echo that. Yeah, I knew you were going to answer that because you and I have chatted about this. It's up to you.
I refuse to pivot. I really want Book Expo back as well. Let's make it not controversial.
We'll have two votes for
that. Coming home with a giant stack of books and a new tote bag and all that kind of just excitement of being the Javits Center. I miss it. And I think it will be back soon. We'll manifest it.
Oh, what's BookCon? Is BookCon, how is BookCon? What is BookCon?
So different. That is different
for like readers. So it's got like it. Book Expo is for us, the publishing
professional readers.
Yeah.
And so what kids would happen there? Agents would come by. If I was the editor, agents would come by and they'd show me a list of the projects that they were looking at for the following, you know, quarter, maybe whatever they had coming soon. And I put my initials next to the ones I was interested in. And lo and behold, that project would show up in my inbox 2 weeks later. It was so efficient. I love this.
So oh God, what I killed love BEA? That. What killed BEA?
COVID.
It's expensive.
Money.
Well, I think it was gone before COVID. I just think it's so expensive. I mean, publishers spent like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to have this huge booth and display their books and have all their staff there. And the booksellers had to fly in from all over the country wherever it was taking place. It wasn't always at Javits. It would sometimes be
Chicago.
It was really a travel East Coast, Midwest, you know, all across the country every year. But I think it was just the expense of it, frankly. It's sort of like why sales conferences don't exist in the same way they used to, where the publishers would fly in everybody and staff, like literally everybody who was involved in selling and making books would come to these conferences and they'd have it in these fun places, really fun places, I have to say. I just think it's an economics, hate to say it.
Definitely.
I don't want to be the doomsayer here, but I think that's what it was.
Well, I mean, very specifically, I think it's the fact that they don't have booksellers like that anymore. I think it's the fact that the retail environment is so much smaller, not smaller in terms, but like so much more, what's the word I want? Like unified, like it's Amazon, it's Target. It's like these one-stop shops, whereas there used to be so many small little independent bookstores, although the independent bookstore is coming back with the full force.
Great.
Yes.
Totally agree with you.
All the snaps. So mine was also stolen. And then what I will do then is come up with a new one because I actually wanted a lot of things to come back. I would bring back just more media outlets that cover books, you know, like more media outlets because this is an increasingly shrinking category. Like it feels like every day we have, you know, fewer and fewer, and then that frustrates me. And so more really great media outlets with budgets, you know, like I want a budget. I want money. I like money. I'm very unapologetic about this. Money's fun. Let's talk about how money's fun. So yeah, that's what I would bring back. That's my spiel.
I agree with you, but what you're talking about are like professional outlets, because there's actually a plethora of book talkers out there, like human beings.
And I want those to stay. Like I want both.
Oh, you want both. Okay. I don't know.
Yes,
like,
I want both. Yeah.
Cece wants
I'm not like Cece
wants
one
everything.
Or the other.
She's not one or the other girl. I love that.
No.
Why choose between vanilla and chocolate?
Yes. Just have both. Have specifically vanilla bean ice cream with chocolate fudge. Like that's the right way to go.
Oh, yeah. That's
And chocolate cookies on top. I know you.
Okay. I'm going to move on to our next question from the audience. This one's going to be, because I want to ask a few questions just for a few people, just so that we can ask more, because I, you know, or else we won't have time for everything. Laura, all I hear from my agent, this is an agented author, all I hear from my agent is how much editors move. Why do you think that happens?
Oh, there's a lot of moving. That's a good question and a true question. Editors do move their jobs a lot. They're like literate tumbleweeds. But this is not because they're not flaky. This is not about flakiness. As in most things, when we ask questions about public, but why, to follow the money thing. I think it's a follow the money thing. Tell me if you disagree, you guys, but this is my take on this. publishing is a precarious industry. It's not like there are these wide margins of profit. It's very hard to make a profit on any book, no matter what it is, let alone an entire list at an imprint at a big publishing company. And at any time, if that margin gets even smaller than what the publisher was predicting, it makes a lot of anxiety in-house. And the people who sit in the offices and make decisions about organizing companies, they're going to want to fiddle. They're going to want to, instead of letting the pressure trickle down and live in a space where their books aren't making as much profit as possible in that little margin, is they're going to say, let's pivot, let's streamline, let's future-proof, let's course-correct, and they'll want to fiddle with things. Maybe they'll merge two imprints. Maybe they'll take an imprint and split it into two. I know an editor that's had the same job, but under five different imprints through all the time that she's been working, because she keeps getting acquired or shifted or traded out. And editors live with that instability. They live with the knowledge that at any point, if the numbers aren't looking great, the publisher or their boss will say, let's make a change. And that might mean you lose your job. Your team gets absorbed by another team. They don't need you anymore. They're going to fold your imprint. They're going to start a new imprint, whatever it is. So if you're a smart editor and you don't want to not have a job, and you see there's a very cool job at another imprint, you might want to make a little leap where it looks like the ground is a little more stable. If the industry overall, if the profit margins were more stable and predictable, I think we would see less moving around. Of course, I don't know. That's another question for the crystal ball, but I think it has to do with the money. The job instability for editors is so much pressure. I really feel for editors. Let's all save the editors, people. They work so hard and for so little safety net. So thank you, editors, for all that you do. And I'm not only saying that because I used to live in that space for so long. It continues to this day that editors do everything for everybody and they love what they do. If they didn't love it, they probably hate it, but they do love it. And staying in one job for a long time is a rare, exciting thing for an editor.
Yeah, I know a couple acquiring editors who listen to this. So they will now love you even more, Laura. Kelly, did you want to say something?
I was going to say, I think it's also about opportunities for growth and promotion. Yeah. Oftentimes, I don't think if you stay, they're going to give you that raise you need and deserve. So unfortunately, I think that's a driving force as well for why people
switch
around. So
like you have to move out in order to move up, because that's what I hear too.
That's kind of the vibe I get from editors.
But it's still a follow the money. It's a follow the money.
It's all about the money, definitely. On both sides.
Publishing, we love you. You drive us bananas. But
I do think that's every industry. You always quit your way to rich. That's every industry. Yeah. The problem why we're so aware of it is because publishing is actually a very small industry, you know?
Yeah.
But who stays at a particular bank for 45 years?
I also think that the reason we notice it more might be because of the long runway for a book to come out. So, you know,
we sell a book and then there's
a lot that can happen, you know, before the book comes out. If books came out a month after they got acquired, we probably wouldn't feel the pain as much. Can you imagine that world, guys? We just sell books and they come out. Guys, if you're not watching on YouTube, you have to, because Callie's face when I said that purely magical hypothetical, she was like.
Yeah. When I tell people outside of the industry that it takes 2 years for the book to pub, they don't believe me. Like, wait, that book hasn't published yet? I'm like, no, I sold it last year. Yeah. What are you talking about? Yeah. It's hard for them to wrap their mind around.
Like my non-publishing friends think I'm crazy. They're like, what, 2 years? No, that makes no sense.
Exactly.
I mean, even authors are shocked by it, right? Well, an author is shocked by it. You sell their book and you're having a conversation with them and their editor the first week after you make the sale. And they're saying, we're thinking of publishing the book 2.5 years from now. Yeah. Right? I mean, I think it's just shocking to people. Even people who are authors, want to be authors and have sold their book, they're surprised how long it takes. And
even readers.
To do it right. And you don't want to rush it. You really don't want to rush it.
You don't want to rush it.
You don't. A long runway is so useful. I mean, just look at Charisse's anecdote about her week, right? Like, Charisse, you've been working with your two clients whose books come out next year, and you're doing all this marketing, all this publicity, and like, you need that runway to build a buzz and to make sure that those books will break out and be the success that
I mean, two that years actually goes by really quickly, actually. Yeah, that's the weird does. Thing. 2 years goes by really quickly. You know, I mean, compared to a magazine where you blink and there it is coming out of a, you know, a printing machine, that's one thing. But you could go, you could work on a movie for 10 years before it's made. So.
That's so true. Okay. So Wendy, this one's for you. Can Ooh. Agents be friends with other agents outside their agency, or is it always a frenemy situation? P.S. This author who sent in this question asked me to add that she is writing a book not about agents, but about frenemies. So, for whatever that's
interesting. Interesting. That's a great topic. I'm going to say yes, agents definitely can be friends with other agents outside their agency. I have many friends who are agents. I don't like the word frenemy, or listen, it's a real word, and there's definitely frenemies. But I think what it is that agents in some sort of innate way are competitive. That's what makes us good agents, is we're competitive. And mm-hmm. so it's hard not to feel like you're always selling, even when you're with your agent friends, like you're talking about the deal you just made or the author you just signed or the big review you just got with your author. So I don't think that's a frenemy. So I'm going to give, that was a half and half answer.
I like that. Okay, Callie, this one's for you. What's something that's changed for you in your life / agent life in 2025? Was it a positive change or a negative change?
Well, I think the team knows that I got married this year. So it was a very positive change. But I do think it's, you know, impacting my taste in books as well. Like I read The Wedding People this year. I read The Husbands. Oh. I'm definitely interested in books that grapple with that kind of, you know, new marriage and or like planning a wedding. There's just so much drama that's rife with all that. So yeah, that's the big update from me.
I love that.
Definitely positive.
Yeah. And it's a change in your life and agent life, because as you said, it affected your taste.
Yeah.
They say that if you want to learn about a person, an editor or an agent, go look at their books. So anybody who wanted to get to know Callie, if they followed along what she's reading or acquiring, they might learn a little bit that reflects her personal life. I mean, that makes sense, right?
It does.
Okay, it makes sense, but I want to go on the record and say that I represent some disturbing books, guys. This does not reflect my life, okay? It might reflect my inner life, but my life is quite nice and tame, okay? I want to go on the record and say that. Okay, Charisse, this one's for you. And this person specifically asked me to ask you.
Oh, gosh.
Can you please ask Charisse? I know she's close to queries, but I need to know this about her purely because I'm curious.
Oh.
What is your editorial process like with your fiction clients?
Oh, it depends on who the fiction client is. It depends on what they need from me and what they want from me. So I could have an author, I could have a client like Diane Marie Brown, who gives me a manuscript. That's like, and here's a manuscript. I'm like, oh, you're working on something. I mean, I kind of always know she's working on something, but I know about the, it's funny, Sadiq was calling me right now. I know about the book when she delivers a draft to me, right? And then on the flip side of that is Sadiqa, who's calling me right now, who will schedule a telephone call with me and say, I'm thinking about the book and it sounds like this, right? So it really just depends on the client.
Gotcha.
Is the answer to that question. Whether how much support they need.
You adapt to your clients. That's your style.
I adapt to my clients. And probably Charisse. In 2026, they will be further adaptations. But for
I
now,
love that.
I adapt to, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, actually. And I actually love editing very deeply. You know, I love moving words around on the page. I love sharing ideas. Like I actually really love that part of it. Before I was an agent, I was briefly a writing coach. Before that, you know, I was an editor. So I love that part of the process a lot. And some people want that. And some people will seek me out for that. And other people just want a different relationship. And that's completely fine.
Okay, question for everyone. What is the one prediction you'd make about where publishing is heading in 2026? Callie, we'll start with you.
My prediction for 2026 is that publishers will be looking to Substack more. They're definitely paying attention to engagement. So it's not just follower count. They want to make sure that you have like a rabid audience ready for your work. But I also think in terms of the books that publishers are looking for, they're definitely focusing on things that maybe are escapism for the reader. They want like some kind of happier endings. I'm kind of hearing that that's the vibe. We want things that are, you know, uplifting, because reality is disturbing as it is.
Okay, awesome. Laura, you next. What's the one prediction you'd make about where publishing is heading in 2026? Or you can do what Kelly did and share too, because, you know, Kelly went rogue and you can go rogue too.
I'd like to go rogue. I think we're going to continue and push the envelope on drama. I think that big, noisy, urgent, wow, knock it off the page books are going to be what editors are looking for. It's not new to say that editors will, and editorial teams, publishing teams will sit in the ed board room and bemoan that a project is wonderful, but a little quiet, right? That's the word we hear. A little quiet means we're not sure we can get enough attention for it. But urgent means there's high drama, there's impact, there's energy behind it in a very dramatic way. And I think next year is going to be a year where anything that even hints at quiet will be a hard sell.
Okay, Charisse, what about you? What's your one prediction for 2026?
I had time this time to prepare. What is my prediction for 2026? I actually think we're going to be surprised. I think that publishing operates with certain assumptions, right, that are about like publishing companies sell what has sold well before, and that there are certain tropes and genres that we all know and that we're all comfortable with are going forward. I think 2026 will be the rise of quirky, actually. I think that what we're seeing, especially among people who are under 30 and under 25, they want something precious. They want, they're actually very old school. They're very nostalgic leaning. And so I think that means that there's going to be these phenomenons that pop up about very quirky, like a very quirky book is going to come to the forefront and take everybody by surprise. That's what I predict.
Ooh, I like that. I hope so too. Okay, Wendy, how about you? What's the one prediction you'd make about 2026?
Well, I'm going to say that doing this a long time, we all know this. I've been in publishing so long. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And in publishing, and this probably is true in other industries, good quality will always rise to the top in terms of the marketplace. And that doesn't mean that every book that you think is good is going to sell well. That's just like not possible. But I still think that there may be different categories that end up coming to the surface because of changing times. But good books are good books and will always find a way to the marketplace. So I don't know that that's a prediction so much as a stabilizer. I think that we are in this business for all the right reasons, every one of us. And, you know, I think we always have to trust our judgment and our instincts, because at the end of the day, an agent is first and foremost a reader. Right? What speaks to you, like when I read something, someone sends me something and I know right away, and I get goosebumps. I'm so excited about it. I can't stop thinking about it. It populates my mind when I'm falling asleep and when I'm sitting on the couch having coffee in the morning. Like that's, you know, you're going to sell that book. You don't know what the price is going to be, but you know, you can get other people excited about it. So whether it's a genre of this or that, it doesn't matter. It's just like the good books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The books that make you feel curious and emotionally invested and that make you forget about the world outside. That's why we do what we do. I love that. Okay. Yeah. So now I will share the last question from the audience, which we will not answer. No one's allowed to answer this question. I am censoring this question. It was sent by a very funny writer from the writing community. I know who you are. She has a great agent.
you're a lovely person, but she meant this as a serious question, but I'm going to censor it. Are your meetings now longer since Cece joined the team because she talks a lot? And I'm not letting anyone answer that one. We're not doing that one. We're just going to ignore and go and smile and flip our hairs. Okay, so guess what we're going to do now? We're going to play Never Have I Ever. So for context to listeners, we played Never Have I Ever, and by we, I mean Callie, Laura, and myself. We're just having like a, you know, New York lunch in between publishing meetings. We'd taken some meetings in the morning. We still had some meetings in the afternoon, and we played Never Have I Ever. And we posted this. You can find this in the Wendy Sherman Associates Instagram. If you don't follow us, you have to, at @WSA_literary. And so I'm so excited because now we're going to get to play the five of us. No, I have tea, but you guys are welcome to grab wine, coffee. If you need a minute to grab something, go for it. Okay. So we all have our drinks. So this is how it's going to work. I am going to, for our listeners who are not familiar with the game, because it has a confusing name, I am going to say a statement prefaced by the words never have I ever. And if this statement is true to you, you drink. Here's what that means. Never have I ever read a book. We would all drink because we've all read books. And if you haven't read a book, no one here, you just wouldn't drink. And because some of you guys are listening and not watching, I will say who took a sip. So if you hear me say names, those are the people who did take a sip. But I highly recommend watching this one on YouTube. Just saying, you guys, you shouldn't pause this now and go to YouTube. Okay, I'm going to start. So excited. Never have I ever made a friend from a client. We all drank. Okay. Never have I ever sold a book that several other people told me was unsellable. Okay. The only person who did not drink was Charisse.
But you know what? I don't know if anybody ever tells me that. So.
Fair. No one would say that to the queen. Okay. Never have I ever cringed at something a client said on social media. Everyone drank, but Laura took her time, which made me think that Laura was going through a very long list of things or that she was embarrassed to drink. Just saying. Okay. Never, clients, we love you. Never have I ever worried that AI would destroy publishing.
I knew Callie was going to sip.
The two millennials drank, Callie and myself. Like we, you know, the younger you are, the more doom and gloom. This is what I think.
Yeah, don't worry about what you can't change and can't control.
If that were me, I'd have so much free time. Like. Okay. Never have I ever, this is when it's controversial, guys. This one's controversial. Never have I ever been tempted, the word is tempted, to poach another agent's client. I'm the only one who's drinking, aren't I? I am.
Good. I would never do it.
But I would never do it, but I've been tempted.
I would never do it. But have I looked a little like, oh, but maybe that person will decide they don't want to be an agent anymore and then it would be my turn for them?
Temptation is defined by a desire in your heart, a strong desire in your heart. I am calling bullshit on anyone who's not drinking. I don't believe you.
I'm drinking.
I agree.
I'm changing my vote.
Wendy's drinking. I've been Callie, did you
drink? Peer pressure. No, Callie would never.
Callie didn't drink.
No, Callie and Charisse are the Gryffindors of the group. I don't believe you. I just don't. Sorry. Okay. Never have I ever regretted choosing a specific editor when submitting a project. Okay, everyone drank for that one. Yeah. I mean, we submit to so many editors, right? Like, it's bound to happen. Never have I ever wanted to represent a writer that was not in my genre expertise. I feel like I want to define this. Expertise meaning something that's on your wish list. I have. Okay, everyone except Laura, I think, drank. Yeah.
If it's so far afield from what I feel confident in, I don't think that I want that pressure of doing right by them. I know someone else will do a better job, but I do like the idea of being like consigliere, somebody who's like on their board of advisors, in their corner, friend of the book. I want to be in it somehow, gotcha. But not as the agent.
Oh, I like friend of the book. Oh, I'm going to use that.
Friend of the book. That's a good title. That's a good title for like something. Like a, yeah, friend of the book. Okay. Never have I ever reached out to an author to ask them to send me their materials or query. For nonfiction, I have.
Definitely.
For both fiction and nonfiction, I have.
Wait, you mean like, have I ever asked someone who I was interested in to send me stuff?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm interested. Would you like
to do reach out to an author? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because usually authors reach
to
us.
Like an author, like someone who's written.
No, sorry. You're right. That was misleading. I think the person meant to someone that you want to be an author. Like, they're not an author.
Oh.
Yet. Yeah. Sorry. That was on me. I should have edited that one. Okay. Never have I ever found a fiction client through social media. No one is drinking to this one, guys. Zero agents drank for this one. So please stop worrying about your social media platform for fiction. Never have I ever sent a client a text or email that was meant for someone else. Oh God, I have to drink a lot. Okay, Bianca and Bruno. Bruno is my husband's name. BB, I have sent Bianca multiple text messages like, can you pick up toothpaste? Thank God that's all the messages said.
I was about to say, that's easy.
Thank God. Because we both use WhatsApp. It's a thing. Anyway, Bianca, sorry, you're probably listening. And I apologize for all the times I asked you to pick up toothpaste. I was not talking to you. Okay. So now, as we're getting to the end of our episode, each of us is going to share a message to the writing community as we head into 2026. This message can be a reflection, guidance, advice, a question, anything that you want to impart to the writing community in the year to come.
I'll start. Please follow submission guidelines. You don't want to be rejected on a technicality. And just also remember, it only takes one person to believe in you and champion you. So it doesn't matter how many rejections you face, just keep going. No one's going to hand it to you. So you have to go out there and put yourself out there and you'll succeed as long as you keep trying.
That's so good.
Laura, what about you?
To all the writers who listen to this podcast, who take classes, who join groups, who engage in the industry in whatever ways it can from wherever they live, know that you are already head and shoulders above most of the submissions that we see. You're already on the right track. There's so many projects that come to us from people who don't do that, and it shows in their work. It shows that they have not engaged. They have not learned why it's important to know what your word count is. They don't know what the word query is. Because you know all of these details, because you listen to this podcast, because you follow along, you're going to rise to the top and have some serious consideration. Does that mean you'll find the exact agent that's right for you? I can't predict any of that. But I do know you'll be taken seriously because you're doing this work here right now.
I love that one. Thank you, Laura. Okay, Charisse, what about you?
I mean, it's almost building on what Laura just said. I want to thank the authors who are out there. I want to thank the writers, right? Because it's so easy to not do the thing. It's so easy to not listen to that inspiration that's been burning inside of you. It's so easy not to, it's just the way that we can skip the gym, some of us don't skip the gym, but just the way that you sort of wake up in the morning, you're like, am I going to go to the gym or not? I won't, right? Like nobody cares if you don't go to the gym. Nobody cares really if you don't sit at your desk and do the work until the work is done. So I just like to thank writers for showing up for themselves and for whatever inspiration is imparted to them from the universe that they commit to putting, I was going to say on the page, but on the screen, I suppose, for other people, because books really do matter and you're the beginning of that entire project.
Love that. Wendy, how about you?
Yeah, I'm going to just speak up and agree with what Laura and Charisse have said, because I have so much respect for people who put the time in get up early before their kids are up, stay up late after their husband's asleep, and do the hard work of writing. Just sitting there and thinking and putting it on the page, I'll say on the page, it is so hard. And I have so much respect. I'm in awe of the hard work and the dedication and the faith you have to have in yourself. And putting in the time and the effort, that is just not a small thing. So, I mean, I say thank you to those people, and you don't need me to validate whether your book is good. You don't need any agent to validate. That's not what this is about. It's not good or bad. It's just, it's a hard way to choose to make a living or to choose to spend your time. So I just say thank you. I think that it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
Wendy, this is a sidebar, but I have to say it. I have many favorite things about you. My number one favorite thing about you is that you've been doing this for so many years, and you sound just as excited and enthusiastic as I'm sure you sounded on day one. Do you know how rare that is? Do you know how rare it is for someone to have all your experience and keep that sense of wonder and appreciation and awe?
So true.
That's amazing. That is amazing. I just want to say that. I will share a piece of advice, if I may, with the writing community. I know it's unsolicited advice, but I guess if you guys listen to the podcast, you might want my advice. If you don't, just skip this part. Here's my advice. Make 2026 the year that you make at least one big investment in your writing. That could be anything. It could be like, I'm going to write for X hours a week. I'm going to be protective of that time, carve it out, and really focus. It could be a course. It could be joining a writing group. It could be going to a library and talking to librarians and just being like, hey, can you tell me like what books get checked out the most and what's happening? It could be anything, okay? But make it the year where you invest in your writing and you invest in your career as an author in ways you can control. I think it's awesome to have get an agent, get a book deal, become a bestseller as a goal. I do. But these are not goals that are dependent only on you. Whereas certain things do depend only on you, you know, like if you make it your goal to write for, I don't know, 4 hours a week or however long you have, that is something you can control with a lot more probability, one might say. So that's my message to the writing community. And I also want to say that after hearing all these lovely messages, if you guys are interested in knowing a little bit more about what each of us are looking for, you can obviously go to our website, wsherman.com, but you can also go to our Instagram. The handle is @WSA_literary. And there is a pinned post with the very top things on our manuscript wish list. Because, and I say this because one of the questions we got from multiple people is, what's at the very top of your wish list? Now, we all have very long wish lists, as we should. But if you want to know what's at the very top, take a look at this pinned post on Instagram. And if you want, leave a little comment and let us know that you were there, because we're going to be so excited to hear from you. Okay, so now the very last question that we ask of all our guests on the show: share a book that you recommend to our listeners. This is a book that they will have the opportunity to read in 2026. It can be a client book, a non-client book, anything you want. Okay, we'll start with Wendy this time. Wendy, you go first.
I just read a book that I love that was recommended to me that I might not have picked up if it hadn't been recommended. And it's called The Correspondent.
Oh.
And I mean, it's, you know, it became a bestseller long after, not long, but like months after it was published, because word of mouth. And what I love most about that is that word of mouth still works. You don't have to get launched out of the gate as a bestseller. People read your book, they fall in love, they recommend it to other book lovers, and it just like snowballs into a huge success. And to me, that's the beauty of knowing people that read and sharing what you want to read and what you love.
I love that. Laura, you might remember when we met with Amy Einhorn, she shared that book story with us. Do you remember?
I do. I remember it. Yeah. And I have it right now on my shelf. I just started reading.
Me too.
It is so good. Yeah. It is so good. She was not wrong.
Yeah.
What a gem. Correspondent.
I love
Definitely.
That. Okay. What about you, Charisse? What about you? What's your recommendation?
Show and Tell?
Show and Tell.
Yes. Oh, is it going to be backwards? That's annoying. Is it backwards? It is. Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
I mean, no, we can see it. Yeah.
So my client published this book, Disappointing Affirmations. It was a nice lovely bestseller and continues to sell really, really, really well. This is his second book, Sorry in Advance for Making Things Awkward, a disappointing affirmations collection. And it is such a perfect hostess gift. It's the perfect gift. You're walking into somebody's house for a holiday party, for a New Year's Eve party. This is a great book to show up with because everyone's going to laugh and have fun on it. And they're doing a huge campaign with him in January for the new year, same you kind of thing. And it's really funny. And I recommend it for 2026, January 2026.
Exciting. I definitely have to get that one. I'm a fan. Okay, Laura, what about you?
My little book tip here, I think, is going to be that we have such a healthy channel from book to screen, which is wonderful. I love seeing a story told in different ways. If you are planning to see the movie Hamnet, I highly recommend also reading the book. If you haven't read the book, read it, listen to it, watch it, do it all, because it's that good. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous story. And I'm excited to see it on the screen, but I decided that I was going to read it again before I did that. And I'm getting so much out of it. I think it's going to make the movie even more glorious.
I love that one. What about you, Callie?
I have to do a plug for Wendy and my clients, of course, Blair Horton. Her book comes out tomorrow, December 30th. So when this airs, the next day. It's a mocktail cookbook. The recipes are delicious, but it also offers different health benefits in each recipe. And all the ingredients are seasonal and the photography is stunning. And you just want to, you know, it's a great way to start the new year, new you, and dry January. So please go out and get that one tomorrow.
Okay. I love that. Okay. I will plug in a book as well as we wrap this up. And I'm going to be honest here. I'm being sneaky because there is someone, a very special someone who has affected all our lives, who does not plug in her own books. She never talks about her own books, certainly not in an encouraging you to buy her book sort of way. Whenever I try to do it because she's always around me, she doesn't let me. She's not here today. And so I'm going to go rogue and say, buy Bianca's latest novel. It's called A Most Puzzling Murder. It is so much fun. Think Glass Onion meets Succession. Like, you're going to want to know everything about this locked room murder with this very quirky, fun protagonist called Destiny, who's like so brilliant. And at the same time, like, she keeps missing all these things and you want to like shake her and at the same time hug her. And the book is just the best. So if you've already read A Most Puzzling Murder by Bianca Murray, I highly recommend checking out The Witches of Moonshine Manor. Hum if you don't know the words. And I should say, if you want to make God laugh. So essentially all of Bianca's books. She's going to be so mad at me when she sees this because she's always telling me the podcast is not about promoting my books. I do not care, B. You can be mad at me and I will continue texting you to pick up toothpaste. So get mad at me. Watch me not care. Okay. Thank you everyone for joining us. It's been so much fun.
This has been so much fun.
Thanks, Cece.
Hello, everybody. I am Emily Summer. I'm here for my monthly comps segment. So thank you for listening. Thank you for sending in your comp requests. And I'm here without Bianca. So we'll see if I can do this on my own. I will confess that I just did the entire recording without it adequately recording. I did not have the right screen on. I was trying to read my notes and did not realize that it had not recorded. So we're going to try it again. That's what happens when I'm on my own. And we'll get started. We have 9 today. So thank you all for sending them in. And thanks for being here now.
Hello, Emily. Thank you for helping me find appropriate comps for my YA speculative dystopian novel with crossover appeal and an important romantic subplot. So far, the strongest comp I've considered is Legend by Mary Lou, because of the similar world-building and dual POV structure. But I'm worried it's too old to use. The story is set 100 years in the future, where the world is united under a single nation ruled by a powerful family seen as humanity's saviors. The novel follows two estranged cousins. After one loses her father in a house fire, she discovers he stole something from dangerous people, and a message from him urges her to find her aunt. This sends her straight to her cousin, who struggles with severe anxiety and a history of mental health challenges, and together, they uncover buried family secrets while being hunted by soldiers. The story explores themes of revenge, sacrifice, family, confronting anxiety, and trust. Thank you so much.
Okay, our first, I'm going very slowly now so I don't do the same thing that I did earlier. Talk to myself for half an hour and then realize it didn't do it. So when I hear someone mention Legend by Marie Lu and a YA dystopian, as I have done in the past, I mention Scythe by Neil Schusterman. It is probably like Legend, too big and too old, but he does dystopian so well that that always comes to mind and I always want to mention it and recommend it. But in thinking of some more recent novels that might also fit the bill, I thought about Chloe Gong's Cold Wire. So that is a YA dystopian that came out this year in 2025 and did very well for us. We did an event for Chloe at East City Bookshop and people were hyped for it. People loved it. So I would take a look at Cold Wire. And I have recommended Tracy Dion's Legendborn series before. Her newest Oathbound, the third in the trilogy, came out this year. And I think that might also work. It's more fantasy than dystopian, but it has a little bit of romance, I believe. And I think the audience is probably right. And I know based on the enthusiasm in our staff that it's wonderful and has a lot of fans and has sold a lot of copies.
Hi, I'm looking for comps for my YA rom-com Willow Hawkins Lessons in Bearding. 15-year-old Willow agrees to serve as her best friend Theo's beard for a few months, desperate to stop the bullying he's faced for his peers' correct assumptions about him being gay. After Theo decides to come out to his sister Avery, the three of them form an unlikely trio. As Willow's friendship with Avery deepens, she eventually realizes she has romantic feelings for her and must decide what she is willing to give up in order to protect her best friend. Comps I was thinking were I Kiss Shara Wheeler for the humor and the theme of having a complicated relationship with the place you call home, or the show Heartstopper for the wholesome energy and heartwarming queer romance with a heavy focus on beautiful friendships. But I think Heartstopper and Casey McQuinston are too big to comp to. My story also includes theater kid and athlete camaraderie. Willow and Theo are in theater, and Avery's their school's track and cross-country star, and a subplot of saving their school's theater program from budget cuts. Thank you for this incredible podcast.
Okay, this one sounds so sweet. I love the synopsis. I do think that Heartstopper is probably too big at this point in time, but I think that I Kiss Shara Wheeler might be good. It's not as big as Red, White, and Royal Blue. I think that as a YA author, Casey McQuiston is not as huge as she is in the adult space. So I think that one could be a good one to mention. And I would also mention David Levithan's Will Grayson, Will Grayson. It's too big because it was co-written with John Green. So we all know John Green, big, big, big. And it's too old. So Will Grayson is probably not the right one to mention in your query letter, but it's excellent. And it is definitely worth reading anyway. It has that camaraderie in different kids in different high school cliques. It has the theater kid vibes to the hilt. Just absolutely a great mix of sweet teen friendship and romance, and it's wonderful. But David Levithan is pretty prolific. So he has continued writing. He's written a lot since then. He had a book this year that came out this year, but that was an adult book. I would not be surprised if one of his more recent books could hit the right notes of sweet teen friendship, queer romance, Save the High School, or some combination of all those things. Another book that I think is a very good fit is from East City Bookshop favorite R. Eric Thomas. He is a playwright and an essayist, and he wrote a great YA novel called Kings of Beemore. And I think that one could be perfect. It's got a very delightful teen rom-com heart. It's a friendship stories. It's got queer characters. They've got a project to focus on. It's wonderful. So take a look at Kings of Beemore.
Hi, my name is Tatiana, and I will appreciate your help with comp titles for my book, In the Place Between, an upmarket speculative novel for readers who love the Midnight Library and Twice. It follows Mira, a 30-year-old ex-founder who sold her startup only to find herself professionally and personally stalled. When she slips into a timeless realm called The Place Between, she's offered three wishes, which she can test before committing. With the help of a dry-witted advisor, she steps into simulations that explore self-optimization and world-saving fixes, only to realize that every perfect solution comes with a cost. After she makes her wishes, Mira and the advisor uncover a deeper crisis, The place between is unraveling under the weight of dangerous, buried wishes and the forgotten origin of the realm itself. The characters are forced to confront not just what broke the system, but what broke them. Mira must choose between clinging to the illusion of control or rewriting the rules entirely before the place between consumes everyone who ever sought refuge inside of it. Thank you.
Hi, Tatiana. Thank you so much for sending in your comp request. So I'm trying to think, whenever anybody mentions Midnight Library, I'm trying to think of other fiction that contains elements of magical realism and is speculative, but isn't straight up genre fantasy. And that can be a hard mix to find. So one author that I think does it really well is Alex Harrow. She definitely skews more fantasy than regular fiction, but maybe The 10,000 Doors of January or the books of Adrienne Young, like Spells for Forgetting. And I also think that it's worth mentioning The Ministry of Time by Kulian Bradley, which came out last year. In terms of upmarket speculative fiction that really broke out and asks very interesting questions, you can't do any better than The Ministry of Time. I also like this one for your comp because it feels very modern and fresh. So it's actually futuristic, but it has more like tech startup, modern day main character vibes than the sort of dreamy Southern Gothic feel of the others that I mentioned. Those feel a little, I don't know, a little dreamier, gauzier, and The Ministry of Time is a little more grounded and sort of modern feeling. So that's my suggestion.
It's Linda Leffler. My novel, working title, The Lillian Effect, is a love story between two workaholic engineers. My heroine, Annie, struggled to maintain a big career and meet domestic expectations as a wife and mother. Throughout the book, in short chapters, Annie reckons with the legacy of a historical figure, engineering trailblazer of a century ago, Lillian Gilbreth, at the forefront of industrial efficiency while parenting a dozen children. There's resonance with Noelle Hancock's memoir, My Year with Eleanor, and a little overlap with Ali Hazelwood's Love on the Brain, where the scientist character references Marie Curie, but that's more superficial than I'm doing. Do you have any comps for me? Thanks so much. I always really enjoy listening to this segment. Cheers.
Okay, for the Lillian effect, I would agree that Ali Hazelwood doesn't feel right for this project based on what you have said. I thought immediately of Julie and Julia by Julie Powell, her memoir digging into Julia Child's life. But once a memoir has been made into a movie with Meryl Streep, it's too big and it's too old. So forget about Julie and Julia, although that did come to mind. So hopefully I'm on the right track. I also think it's worth considering the novels of Marie Benedict. So hers are mostly straightforward historical fiction about a real person, sort of the imagined historical fiction about their life. But I think if you're doing a deep dive into Lillian Gilbreth and she is an important character and you do go into her life in the story, that Marie Benedict's books might illustrate that aspect of your novel. Something to consider. I also thought of Susan Rieger's novel from last year, which came out from Dial Press, called Like Mother, Like Mother. It is an excellent novel about the struggle between having a big career and being a significant professional figure and balancing your family life. A great book club book. I'm waiting for it to become a prestige HBO drama. I think it's going to. I don't know if it's on HBO, but I do think it's been optioned for television. And I'll also mention Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, one of my favorites of not just the last 5 or 10 years, but maybe ever. And I mention that one because it's a split between historical and contemporary. So in that book, the historical piece, the historical figure is fictional. But I still think it might work. The structure might work. Because in that you have a contemporary character who is doing research on and figuring out how this historical figure can resonate in her modern day life. Plus, it is a masterpiece. So you can't go wrong with masterpiece.
Hi, Emily. I'd like comps for Pearl, my historical novel set in upstate New York in 1934, about a woman trying to hold on to what's hers. When Pearl inherits farmland, she's suddenly surrounded by men who want her land. The friend she quietly loves proposes, but she's not sure if it's from love or greed. When a hobo, actually an escaped convict, offers to fix her roof in exchange for shelter. Tensions mount until a confrontation ends with Pearl shooting the hobo. She conceals the killing, which haunts her until years later, when a stranger threatens to expose her, forcing her to choose between protecting herself and her freedom, and finding atonement. A Piece of the World by Christina Baker Klein is a match for setting, but it is old and it's quiet. My vibe is Humphrey Bogart in The Petrified Forest, not Andrew Wyeth. And I'm hoping for a comp for long-term guilt and atonement. Thanks for any suggestions, Sue.
Okay, for Pearl, I thought immediately of a book that I have certainly mentioned before. Do I sound like a broken record? I feel like I have favorites, and I do have favorites, but I read like 140 books a year, so I should have more than, you know, the same dozen. But the same things come up again and again because they're just that good. And one is The Frozen River by Ariel Lahan. And it's historical fiction at its finest. So it's set a couple of centuries before Pearl is, but the midwife protagonist in that book is a badass, which it sounds like Pearl is too. So I mentioned The Frozen River because it's just so good, and I think the fierceness of the character might work. It's also a great read. It's especially great this time of year. You'll want to curl up in front of a fire. It's just a perfect winter read. In terms of a book about long-term guilt and atonement, I will mention a book that's coming out early next year, A Far-Flung Life by M.L. Stedman. So her previous book, The Light Between Oceans, was huge. That was maybe a dozen years ago. That one might also work, except that it's too old and too big. But M.L. Stedman is finally back. Readers are going to rejoice. I loved this book, and it is the best book about grief and secrets and whether or not we should tell them. Should secrets always come to light? Should we always atone, or should we let things lie? It's wonderful. So look for A Far-Flung Life in the spring. And another one that I don't know, it's just I keep coming back to it when I'm thinking of this one. It's Go as a River by Shelley Reed. I often mention it as a comp to Where the Crawdads Sing. And I don't know, it just feels like it might work here in terms of suspenseful fiction, a real sense of place, a strong female main character, all that good stuff. I don't know, something's just telling me that maybe Go as a River might work as well.
Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for doing this. I'm looking for comps for my upmarket novel, Told Over 1 Week in the summer of 2015. The novel follows a cast of characters connected to one Greek-American family, including two sisters with a fragile relationship. The younger sister is a celebrated food journalist who's failing to finish chapters about her complicated childhood for her memoir that's due in a week. The older sister, who owns a cafe in the same building as their late dad's restaurant, acting on their mother's last wishes, invites the younger sister to stay while she lies about a trip she's taking and goes to Greece to visit family, where she's told a hidden version of their parents' immigration story. Meanwhile, the younger sister spends the week unknowingly gathering missing pieces to the story her older sister is hearing. I've currently comped Blue Sisters for themes of complicated sibling relationships in the wake of grief and multi-point of view storytelling, and Murder, which feels a little bit too big for themes of family baggage, queerness, and immigration. Food contributes a lot to the atmosphere, as well as a misunderstood learning disability, so anything around that would be appreciated.
Okay, for number six, yes to Blue Sisters. Absolutely. I love it when you all mention a book that I have already started thinking of as I'm listening to the voicemail. So I think that that's a perfect one for a sister story of this sort. And I'm going to, again, mention a book that is coming out early next year. I know it's not fair. It's sort of a tease to mention these forthcoming books. But go ahead and reserve these from the library now or pre-order them from your local indie bookstore because you'll want to read them when they come out. And I do think that anything that I mention, I think is going to sell well enough that it will be an eventual very good comp. So the next one I'm going to mention is Leave Your Mess at Home by Tolani Akinola. It's coming from Pamela Dorman Books in April, I believe. It is a marvelous sibling story. It's three sisters and a brother, and it's from one of my favorite editors, Seema Mahanian. She also edited two previous recent favorites of mine, What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez and The Bombshell, which I think I've probably mentioned both of those in the past. But in terms of a good sibling story, multi-POV, sisters, grief, and a lot of good food mentions, look out for Leave Your Mess at Home.
Hi, I'm looking for comps for my open-door, dual POV, high-heat contemporary romance set in Chicago. When Scarlett was younger, the people who were supposed to take care of her left her to fend for herself. Now in her 40s, she's become very successful professionally by sticking to her rule of always doing everything herself. When a chance meeting with a local musician whose band is taking off has her reconsidering her priorities, she decides she must push him away at all costs. He falls hard and fast, though, and wants nothing more than to pierce through that tough exterior. A back and forth results in a deal, a white-hot, just-for-now affair before his band leaves on tour in 6 days. But once they are together, neither of them can deny the connection they share. Will she keep herself protected or allow him in, potentially risking everything? I thought of Allie Hazelwood's Not in Love and Liz Tom Ford's Play Along for their guarded, career-driven heroines, but I'd like something that signals the just-for-now trope. I thought of It Happened One Summer by Tessa Bailey, but I wondered if that was too big and too old. Thank you so much.
Okay, I am not the romance expert. I work with a romance expert. So at East City Bookshop, our romance expert is my colleague, Destiny Hodge. You should follow her on Instagram @yourromancedestiny. And she spells destiny with two E's at the end instead of a Y. So follow Destiny for all things romance. But I think It Happened One Summer by Tessa Bailey sounds right. That sounds good to me, even though, again, I'm not the romance expert. I also thought immediately of The Idea of You by Robin Lee. And that is for a couple of reasons. One, because that's one of my favorite romances ever. I don't need a happily ever after because, you know, I like to cry. So I'm not a huge romance reader, but I loved The Idea of You, as did many others. So I thought of it because I love it so much. And also because in that book, we have an older main character. So we have a 40-ish main character entering into what should be a very temporary situationship. Now, the big hook of The Idea of You that has been discussed in the movie and when people are talking about the book is the age gap. In my head, I aged the character up and just told myself, okay, he's 28, so that I could still enjoy the book. But I think despite, even if there's not an age gap, I think it works for the other similarities between your work and progress. Robin Lee also has a new one coming in 2026. I don't know if it would work, but look out for it. It's probably going to be great, even if it doesn't have anything to do with your current work in progress. And I also have heard that Jill Shalvis, that her books feature some older main characters. And I love Jasmine Guillory, and her book Royal Holiday, I think, is a good one to mention too. So in that one, a mom goes on vacation with her daughter and is quite surprised to find herself in the middle of a vacation fling. So I think all of those might have that sort of temporary, like should be very temporary, and a main character that's not 20. So I like them for that.
Hi, Emily. I'm looking for comps for my literary debut. Laura Jacobs is an unhappy substitute teacher living in rural New Hampshire. This wasn't always the case. She used to be a vibrant executive, traveling the world, being wined and dined with the world's financial elite. But abruptly at 45, she left that life, trading it in for one as close to teaching, as close to nature, and as close to at-risk children as she could find. With a life full of regrets for missing out on motherhood, Laura meets Sawyer, a young farm girl who steals her heart and her car. When Sawyer goes missing, not showing up at school for 3 days in a row, Laura breaks all the rules of the school where she works, determined to find the problematic yet tender girl. My comp right now is old and maybe too big, little fires everywhere. Also, maybe the wedding people. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for writing in about your literary debut. I agree that Little Fires Everywhere is probably too big and too old. And I'm not sure that I would do The Wedding People unless the tone is right, because I think Alison Esbach is so good at writing about very, very, very sad things, but also making it funny. So if that is the tone that you're striking, then go for it, especially if your character Laura is very unhappy, as our main character is in The Wedding People. I love that book. But the sort of scrappy sounding young person and the unexpected friendship remind me most of a book that I've definitely suggested here before because I adore it. And it's Alison Larkin's The People We Keep. It is, I think, the best found family book I've read in the last few years. And in that one, the main character is more of the Sawyer-esque character. She starts as the teen who flees. But you get to see this marvelous cast of supporting characters, the older people who support her, the peers that she finds. But it's really about how these unexpected bonds and unexpected people can influence our lives. I also think a good one to mention might be Mia McKenzie's book, Sky Falling. She also had a book this year called These Heathens, not right for this comp, but it was a great book. I really enjoyed it. But in the case of Sky Falling, Sky also enters into a sort of surprise relationship with a challenging but tender teenager who is her donor daughter. Sky was an egg donor, and the result of her egg donation shows up on her doorstep one day after her mother, who raised her, has died. But it's just super. I love that book. I feel like the cover makes it look like a middle grade book, but it is not. It is an adult book, and it's great.
Hello, brilliant people of Tease Not Y'all. My name is Emily Ernest, and I'm seeking additional comps for my adult horror romance novel. It combines the supernatural elements and page-turning tension of Rachel Harrison's So Thirsty, the irresistible romance and witty humor of Allie Hazelwood's Hot for Slayer, and the brutally authentic commentary on America's healthcare system seen on HBO's The Pitt. My one-line hook is as follows. When vampire physicians integrate into a Pittsburgh hospital as a means to address post-pandemic staffing shortages, an oncology nurse must mentor a brooding vampire while solving the murder of her sister at the hands of the undead. I do feel as though Hot for Slayer may be turning off agents because of the astronomic popularity of Hazelwood's other works. I'm struggling to find comps that have heavy threads of romance but aren't so light. I considered Fang Fiction by Kate Stamen London and Loving a Vampire's Total Chaos by Ara Hayes, but while entertaining, they do not match the darker tone and humor of my work. Any suggestions would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, we're ending today with a fellow Emily. Hello, fellow Emily. All right, I said I was not a romance expert, but my weakest literary spot is probably vampires. However, because we're looking for something with sort of a heavier tone, maybe consider The God of Endings by Jacqueline Holland. That is a vampire story, a story about immortality, and that has some heavier notes and more serious considerations than like a Fang Fiction, although we love Kate Stamen London in my store. But I don't know, it skews sort of literary and historical fiction, so that might not be right. But regardless, I think that Rachel Harrison's So Thirsty meets The Pitt. I think that is fantastic. Like, that puts me there. I love The Pitt, so I'm in it. And, you know, I'm not an agent. I'm not the expert there, but I wholeheartedly support that comp. I think you can't do any better than that. Okay, thank you all for listening. I appear to have accurately recorded myself this time as opposed to last time. I did it faster this time without meaning to. Thank you all for sending in your comp requests. Thanks for listening now. Thank you to Bianca for letting me record. And I hope to see all of you or hear from all of you next year in 2026. Happy holidays.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again, with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.